place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and on Oceanic Flight 815, I was seated in row 23, seat D, near Rose.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and on Oceanic Flight 815, I was sitting in row 2 in first class with Charlie, and I still somehow survived the crash.
And I'm Neil Miller, and on Oceanic Flight 815, I was sitting in seat 15A, and the most likely scenario for me is that I was sucked out of the plane somewhere. I didn't make it.
Well, yeah. Neil, we're going to start this last podcast by saying goodbye to Neil as we crash on a mysterious island for episodes 1 and 2 of season 1 of ABC's Lost. These are pilots part 1 and 2, and they aired in September 2004, which is a long time ago, 15 years ago, this upcoming September, when we're going to finish this season 1 rewatch. Before we kick it off, welcome to the new Lost Rewatch podcast. Joanna, what was your first experience with Lost?
I definitely watched starting in season one, but like a few episodes in, like maybe six episodes in or something like that. And I think my ex-boyfriend who had gone off to grad school and I was still in college, like I was still talking to him on the phone, which is a healthy thing to do with someone you've broken up with. Yeah, it is. It is healthy. And anyway, he was like, have you been watching this last show? It's really good. So I watched it, and I was living in a real, like, maybe the worst place I've ever lived in. A real shithole apartment. But I remember, I will remember it always. That is where I started watching Lost. So I would say midway through season one. And I don't know when I caught up with, like, the first few episodes. But that's when I started. And then I think I dropped off. But then I was back all in for the final few seasons. So.
Interesting. Neil, how about you?
Well, I'm reasonably sure. My memory isn't what it used to be. It's definitely not what it was in 2004. But 2004 would have been maybe the year after I had moved away from home for the first time. So I lived an hour away from Cleveland, in the lovely town of Mansfield, the meth capital of Ohio. And I watched Lost from the beginning. I remember the trailer. I remember seeing the commercials and stuff and being like, holy shit, what is this? And I'm pretty sure I stuck with it all the way through, because we eventually, this was pre-Film School Rejects, so 2 years later I created Film School Rejects, and we covered Lost in the last couple seasons. I think we finally started covering Lost.
Nice. I was the latest adapter of everybody here. I don't think I was on board until like halfway through season 5, which is embarrassing only because the rest of my family was on board. We're a 4-person family. 3 of them watched Lost from the beginning. And then Dave was like, too cool for this ABC show, until he circled back and realized what he was missing. And then for the 6th season, I was, I started developing, an obsession with the mythology of the show. And started working in television. So we would all go out to bars afterwards or watching a live broadcast and get to talk about it and try to figure out what was going on in that crazy last season. And, you know, not to jump ahead too far ahead in our podcast, but lots of people had lots of opinions about it at the time. And so then I spent even more time when I was in New York going back once Lost became available for streaming and being like, I could just do all of this again and I can make it make sense. And that obsession led me to rewatching Lost again. So I think I did for my other podcast, Fighting in the War Room, a project where I took the first season and cut out all the flashbacks and then just presented the season on Ireland chronologically. And I did that as like an exercise to try to distill the story threads of the first season of Lost. So I think this will be like my fourth time all the way through the first season of Lost. And I'm hoping to share some things along the way in the storm. That's right. We're borrowing our format from our Game of Thrones episodes, even though all episodes of Lost are available streaming to you now wherever you watch these first two. If this is your first time with Lost, welcome. Hopefully you've watched the episode before this podcast episode, because we are going to talk about everything we've seen in a section we're going to call The Calm. That means no spoilers, no talking about season two, no talking about season six, no talking about later things that happened in the first season if we haven't got there yet. And foreshadowing exists only within episodes that we've seen, as far as The Calm goes. The Storm, that's when we get to all use our Lostopedia pages, our charts that we've made in like 2008 that are on the back of an Obama change poster, and any sort of other knowledge.
Any that notes we that we've in. Written.
Yeah, exactly. Any broadcasts we've decoded from our past, any of these things will be play in The Storm. If you look down at your podcast description, you will see a time code when The Storm starts. And you're free to hop off and listen to that part later, whenever that later is for you, if you just want to go with us episode by episode. All right, let's kick this off. This would be the part that we would usually read reviews of our show. Joanna, do we have any reviews of our show that we want to read on this Lost podcast?
Sure. I will say, let's say, this one seems, yeah, pretty general and not, too Game of Thrones specific. Yeah, so like, I mean, I, you did a great job contextualizing this, but I just wanted to like, yes and you and say like, you know, we're doing this on a week to week basis. Our idea is to go all the way through Lost, hopefully, if we're all still alive to get through it. The reason we thought it would be fun to do this is because, like, you know, Game of Thrones is a show, was a show that was really fun to obsess over with a potentially problematic ending. Lost is a similar thing. And so we want to sort of revisit the legacy of Lost. People seem really excited. It's been like 15 years since it debuted and they're like, oh yeah, Lost, like now's the time. So we just thought it would be really fun to do that. And yeah, so, we're really hoping that people, I've heard from a bunch of people who've never listened to Storm of Spoilers, which was our Game of Thrones podcast, who are like, oh, you're doing a Lost rewatch? I want to join that. So I think we're going to get like a, you know, I don't know how many, but a few new people onto this feed. So if you have questions, you can email us stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Maybe we'll change that email, but for right now, it's the same one. Any questions, you can email us there. We've got this whole Patreon system. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on. So bear with us as we sort of transition out of one show into another. Where can people find our Patreon again?
Patreon.com/Storm of Spoilers.
Perfect. And then also for people who've been asking us if we're going to like continue to do what we used to call the off-season tour, which is like every week we talked about a different pop culture subject when Game of Thrones wasn't on. We're going to do something similar, but it's going to be in our bonus podcast structure. So if you're...
That's during the Lost seasons, but in between Lost seasons, there might be main feed content as well.
Yeah.
Basically, yes. Patreon.com/Storm of Spoilers is where you get everything.
Okay.
But where you're subscribed right now, great.
Great.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for joining us. All right. Long story short, I will just read one.
You made it.
Review. Yeah, we made it through Game of Thrones together. We're going to do this. We're going to go have a relaxing vacation on an island together. What could possibly go wrong? All right. 5 stars. Scared of Tex-Mex. I've never done this before, but I have to tell you, the show is freaking awesome. The hosts are amazing, guide through the realm, and I appreciate every last hot take, cold take, and crackpot theory. I don't generally agree with their politics. That's okay. But who the heck cares about agreeing all the time? Joanna, 5 stars. Neil, 5 stars. Dave, 5 stars. Thank you for sharing your legendary fandom. Looking forward to what's next in the storm. Pew, pew, pew forever. So thank you guys. And thank, you know, I'm hoping that all of our game, you know, we have a lot of Game of Thrones listeners. I'm hoping all our Game of Thrones listeners join us. I know not all of you will. But I think this is going to be really fun. I'm like really looking forward to watching Lost with all of you.
It's like a form of self care.
It really
watching
feels
the first
that way.
Season of Lost.
It's so good.
It's so good.
Pilot part one.
Back
pilot
when problems
part two.
Were simple, you just had to survive on the island and there was like mystery stuff in the forest.
Yeah. And this is like, yeah, this is the first like crazy event, online, addictive, big piece of epic cinematic piece of television. I mean, it's kind of amazing. Anyway.
It's like the Jaws of TV shows where it's like, it's the first summer blockbuster.
Did you read that trivia that like Lloyd Braun who was the head of ABC got fired right for greenlighting this? Because it was like way too expensive. And they're like,
well, yeah.
What a bad idea, bud. And then they're like, thanks for doing that, bud.
Because they decided to do it all in like a month, like the whole pilot. They went from like outline to cutting a plane into 4 parts in like 30 days. Crazy, Lloyd Braun.
Yeah, it was definitely the most expensive pilot ever shot at the time. Is it still? I feel like it's got to be close. But what even justifies a pilot these days? So maybe, you know, that's another lasting or remnant of old television. The pilot episode was written by J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof. Abrams, you know, pre-Mystery Box TED Talk is going to introduce us to, I think, the best parts of J.J. Abrams here on Lost, which isn't to say that his movie output isn't amazing, and I'm not like looking forward to Star Wars, and I don't like enjoy watching Mission Impossible 3, even if I don't think it's the best Mission Impossible movie. But in terms of guy who was doing like Alias and who wrote Regarding Henry, making the jump to Lost is, I think, showing off of like what Neil was saying, like a masterclass of the job of directing, and also creating the basis for a mystery filled series. I think Damon Lindelof enjoys a lot of that credit, but I think also in past interviews, he's also sort of talked about J.J. Abrams having all these seeds and then Damon Lindelof being the one who with Carlton Cuse had to run the show and sort of take all these seeds and let them branch off and flower how they will. But Lost opening of the Lost pilot is one of the more memorable openings in all television. Specifically, Jack opens his eyes. We have no idea where we are. It looks like he's just woken up in the middle of a jungle, having been, you know, teleported there. And as he walks out onto the beach and turns around, we go off his reaction to like the hell of a plane crash on the beach, which kicks off an extended sequence that is just Jack running around trying to save all the people that he can, people that we'll get to know as series regulars. But in terms of a introduction, this is a fantastic way to introduce people to a bunch of characters while also keeping the tension up. Most, you know, pilots have to spend a lot of Act One just setting the stage and maybe giving some hints as to what sort of characters are going to be together. But very quickly, especially I think for Jack and Boone and Hurley in these opening scenes, their immediate actions are so much speaking to their characters. So we're just like right off the bat, things are exploding. Sound mix is like overbearing. A guy gets sucked into a jetliner. Neil, what's your favorite part of the chaos opening of Lost?
Well, I think it's, first of all, they were crazy to even try this. I mean, it what's really great about it, I think, is one, if you listen to any of the behind the scenes or kind of watch the behind the scenes, some of the first meetings that J.J. Abrams and Damon Lindelof had about this, where they were, ABC was trying to use Lindelof to convince Abrams to sort of get involved. And this opening sequence was sort of one of the first things they talked about. One of the first things they really broke on this series. It's a wild single shot. It's like the first single shot of it's like, what is it, 7 minutes long, where it starts with Jack and it doesn't really cut away from Jack until, I think until after they rescue the guy from underneath the wheels. It's all one piece. So it's wild. And this, like you said, the sound design is just incredible. And it creates this very interesting perspective for the opening of this series. And this is the thing we've talked about a lot, about a bunch of different things where, you know, we're experiencing this crash in the aftermath. We're experiencing it over Jack's shoulder, basically, as he's running around. And it's such a great introduction to a character that is, you know, sort of just generic good guy, I guess. He's, you know, he's a doctor. So, him running, but we don't know any of that yet. We don't know he's a doctor until later in the episode. We don't know why he has a vodka bottle in his pocket. We just know it's there. We don't know why the dog is there. So I love that there's this sense of building the mystery. And I think as Lindelof described it once, it's, you know, we're introducing 14 different stories that we're going to tell throughout this season, but none of that matters yet. Like it's all just people in the background, who will be important later. And then the scale of it's crazy. How they did it was they actually bought a plane and shipped it from California, the Mojave Desert, all the way to Hawaii where they shot the pilot, and they cut the plane up into pieces and then reassembled it on the beach. And, to me, it's one of the wilder stories in the history of any kind of television or movie production where it was like they went from having no story to breaking up a plane and putting it on a beach in Hawaii in a very short amount of time. And, it comes out, it's such an impressive opening piece. And it's even more impressive when you think about the fact that they were sort of making it up as they went along. So, yeah, that whole shot is just wild as hell. Everything that happens up until the big explosion is just rampant chaos, and I love it.
Yeah, and then Joanna, it has like a really good idea of place, which I think is, or geography, I think is what I should say, not necessarily place, which is interesting because as the show goes on, they always have sets that are really good with geography and they shoot to the, you know, strengths of those sets. But all the connection stuff, as we're all going to learn going through this show, we're going to have a lot of jungle walk and talks where like direction doesn't make any sense. Is there anything about the pilot, Joanna, that sticks out for you, cinematography wise, knowing how the series has to, like, can't maintain this scale?
Did you ask Neil the character question and me the cinematography question?
It's a whole new podcast, guys.
It's so funny because I was just thinking how Lost is the perfect show for us to watch because, like, there's all this juicy character shit, which, as we know, is my like jam. There's all this complicated lore stuff, which is Dave's thing, and then there's all this great cinematography, like filmmaking stuff, which is
amazing
Neil's thing.
Technical stuff. Yeah.
So it's just like it's the perfect storm, if you will, for all of us. Cinematography wise, ask Joanna things she doesn't know. Well, I mean. I will say in terms of sense of place, like, I think I said this on, our intro podcast or whatever, like, I lived on Oahu right near where they filmed this. And like Kualoa Ranch, which is like where it's whenever they hike into the valley and you might recognize it from Jurassic Park and stuff like that. Like I'm aware of all of those places and how they are on very different places on the actual island of Oahu and stuff like that. But still I have such a sense of the location of this island, as you say. They just keep it really clear. It's disorienting intentionally. So at the beginning when Jack's like running through the jungle, and there's like a shoe in the tree and stuff like that. And you're supposed to be like disoriented with him and you're supposed to be disoriented with him when he hits the beach. It's my memory that he like hits the beach and you hear screaming before you really get to see everything that he's about to take in. And then just like, it's not a one-er, but like the amount that we're on Jack through all of this and like to yes and what Neil said about, this is a good guy hero. It's also like my feeling, you know, and this is, yeah, obviously flavored by what I know about Jack, but no, I don't think it's a spoiler to say, that Jack is a kind of character who feels like if he doesn't do it, it won't get done sort of thing. You know, like just trying to put out all the fires. Cause if he doesn't put out the fires, no one's going to put out the fires. And that's like, so like, and it's just so there in that first sequence. So did I answer your question? Probably not really, but I said some things. So I've got that going for me.
I really like that point about Jack though, because then what you see is that he runs into all these obstacles that sort of reinforce that idea, which is like, he finds Claire and then he tries to get Hurley to help, and Hurley's kind of useless in that moment. And then he sees Boone, and Boone's trying to give Rose CPR, and it's like, he's not even doing it right. So it's like, it's just this constant
all
thing
on him.
Where,
but yeah. What's interesting is that what emerges in these two episodes are these other leader characters. Like Saeed is a leader in his own way. Kate is a leader in her own way. Like it's not just Jack and the rest, but like in, from Jack's point of view in the beginning, he's the only guy who can get it done. You know what I mean? And I think that is such a good mm-hmm. establishing character beat for who Jack is in this whole series. And like Jack, you know, once again, to like flavor it with like broader knowledge, Jack is a character who gets a bad rap. You know, we'll talk about that more maybe later on, but like, I think the show is critiquing the Jack Hero character as much as it's presenting us the Jack Hero character, which I think is fun. So that's my answer.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I like it. I was thinking that the angles stayed low on the beach, and then as the pilot goes on, the angles get higher until at the beginning of part two, we're above Kate in the reeds. Neil, am I off on that?
No, that's true. One of the things J.J. Abrams talked a lot about, I'm going to do this a lot because I'm watching all these episodes with the commentary tracks on, and not every episode has them, but this episode definitely does.
No, I'm learning I throw to Joanna first, and then I throw to Neil. I'm learning it.
A couple of the things they did is they wanted the island, they wanted these beautiful vistas, these beautiful backgrounds that they were getting from Oahu to become part of the shot. So a lot of what they shot was, they shot things from very far away with very long lenses that creates this feeling that, that you get so much depth, and it creates this weird feeling of like everything feels super close, even though it's far away. So, you know, like when we see Charlie for the first time, Dominic Monaghan, he's like wandering, right? And then a piece of the engine falls behind him. That's the first time we see him, right? Am I not remembering that correctly?
Yeah, that's okay. Our Charlie.
So like they actually, that thing is like 20, 30 feet behind him, but because of the long lens, it looks like it falls right next to him. And so you get that. And then like Dave said, they shoot from a low angle, especially on the beach in a lot of cases, especially and a lot of the walk and talks they do through the jungle are shot lower angle to give you a sense that like the jungle is huge and the island is huge. And I think it's great because one of the things that makes Lost really interesting from the start is that they knew that the island was going to be a character, you know, like they knew the island was important.
Oh no. I both love that, and like that's one of those like buzz phrases that you always want to like push back on, right?
Right.
You know, you really feel like New York City is it's the third character in this love.
But they did a good job of, I think, you know, you think about the conditions under which they did this. It's just a pilot. They didn't know if they were going to get more of a show. They were spending a ton of ABC's money doing this. And they didn't want to waste it. And it creates some really cool cinematography, especially just in the way that you get sort of the massive backgrounds.
And the other thing I wanted to say to sort of contextualize, like this is not unlike anything we've seen on TV before, right? It's huge. The shooting on Oahu. They've like brought in real parts of planes. It's like this whole crazy thing. But then also like I was hoping we could talk about like the way they cast this show, you know, one observation I made when I was watching it was like, okay, it's crazy to think about. It's the same way when you watch Game of Thrones and you're like, Sean Bean was by far the most famous person in Game of Thrones when it started, because of Lord of the Rings. Ditto Donna McMonaghan on, Lost, because he, you know, had just come off Lord of the Rings. So he was by far the most famous. Matthew Fox, famous to Party of Five fans. Terry O'Quinn, famous to like character actor fans, but like, really, you know, a lot of these people, this was like kind of their first or early or a big breakout for them. And a lot of, you know, I know the names of all the actors, not even trying. I know the name of all the actors, after Lost is on, because that's the sort of thing it became. Dave, do you want to drop the like Jack protagonist trivia on people who are maybe experiencing this for the first time?
Like a TBS series called Wrecked that I've talked about on the off-season tour, the original pilot had Jack dying, but this was, I think, even they made the decision to keep him around, from what I've been reading, before it was actually Matthew Fox. So they were already tooling around with the idea, but the first early drafts of Lost had the Jack character not making it through the pilot and actually being much more like the Ned Stark of this series than actually played out.
And my understanding is the whole idea, right, was they were going to cast Michael Keaton, and Michael Keaton was going to play Jack, and he was going to be, yeah, the Sean Bean, the like most famous person in the cast, and he was going to be like the running around the beach, saving everyone, and you're like, here's our hero. And then instead of Greg Gunberg's pilot character in Bloody in the Tree, at the end of episode one, it was supposed to be the Jack character. And then you're like, who is the hero now? And it was supposed to be Kate. So like that's, it's fascinating to me. And then when they decided to do it that way, Michael Keaton's like, yeah, no thanks. I'm a film actor. I don't do TV. You promised me I would die. I thought that was cool. I don't want to like invest in this TV thing you're talking about. And which is when they grab Matthew Fox. But I just think that's fascinating that they like were like, ooh, we're gonna subvert expectations, it's gonna be blah blah, and then they're like, never mind, Jack's the hero. And I'm like, that's fine, I like Jack, but you know,
it's funny, we already mentioned that Lloyd Braun got fired because he greenlit Lost. He is also, according to JJ and Lindelof on the commentary track, the one who convinced them to leave Jack alive.
Yeah, he's just making good decisions, and nobody.
he made all these good decisions and totally got fired.
Ah, oh, poor man. All right,
he's probably fine.
Let's move to Joanna for this one. We get our introduction to Jack and Kate with this stitching up scene that also introduces something that's going to be very effective, at least in these early seasons, is the 5 seconds of fear story. It helps build tension, helps make a character. Do you like this introduction for these two lead characters, watching it again?
I love
knowing who the characters are.
I love it. I love it. Maybe Kate's a little bit more timid than I think she should have been, given what we know about her. But then I think you can make a case that in episode two, we sort of see her maybe kind of pretending to be a little bit more timid than she actually is. I don't know. Your mileage may vary on that. But I love this scene. Apparently this was their like audition scene that they used to like make sure the Jack and Kate characters could like interact well together. And I love the way it's acted. I love Evangeline Lilly in this role as Kate. I just like, I liked it the first time, obviously, but rewatching it, I'm just like, this is incredible casting. She's just like so good in this. And this is like her first thing that she ever did. And she's just like this really appealing blend of like, you know how when you can see someone, like you can just see the TV executives be like, oh, you know, she's cute, but in like an outdoorsy way, and she's gonna be spunky.
We want Linda Hamilton in between Terminator 1 and Terminator 2.
Oh, and the women will like her and the men will like her. It'll be great. So like, I see all of that and it still just completely works on me. I love Kate. I love Evangeline Lilly, in this role. Yeah, I do. I love the scene. What do you think, Dave? What do you think of the scene?
Oh, I don't know if you guys know this about me, and it doesn't really come up with Game of Thrones, but I don't take medical stuff well. So every time he describes slicing the nerve sac and it's spilling out like angel hair pasta, like my palms start sweating. It's happening right now. I just,
well, it's the way, it's too, it's the way that Matthew Fox sort of tells that story, like the horror in his eyes.
It's such a good line too. Like a bunch of our listeners who have been like watching this episode, like I've seen a bunch of them mention that line specifically as like, so good, you know, like just sticking out.
Which also apparently is a real story that someone told J.J. Abrams along the way, like, that it was like somebody whose husband was a surgeon and like they had relayed this story onto him years before.
Yeah, and I just like, I love it that it comes back still in the pilot and that Kate's picked it up in the while hiding from the smoke monster, who I swear we're getting to. All right, so Jack decides that he has to go to the cockpit, or that going to the cockpit's a good idea because that's where the radio could be. He meets some resistance on the beach, but because he saved everybody, it's not like a big deal. Kate steals some shoes off a dead woman, which, you know, great score moment. That's really the moment that I think in this episode, the score steps forward and is like, and I'm going to be a part of this series. And definitely worked on me. And then we hike into the jungle and find Greg Grunberg passed out, uncredited Greg Grunberg passed out in the main section, the front section of the airplane. And he tells them that they something went wrong. They backtracked off course. Nobody knows where they are. Nobody's going to know where to look, even if they are looking for them. And then the weird noises that they heard previously in the episode actually managed to yank the pilot up and out through the fuselage and knocks it around enough that it dislodges from the tree. And I think that's our break in between episodes. So let's talk to Joanna. Joanna, this is like a great drama about surviving on an island. And then right as Rose is saying, doesn't that sound familiar, because it sounds like a taxi receipt printing, we hear mysterious sounds in the jungle and see trees being knocked down.
Wait, what sounds like a taxi? I mean, I know she says, I know that sound, or like, and someone's like, where are you from? And I think she says Brooklyn or something like that. So what was the taxi receipt sound?
The shh.
Oh, okay.
That's like gonna not. Were you actually asking that, or yeah, are you hoping my impression was really good?
No, I was actually asking that. Remember, I'm the dummy on this podcast.
Oh, that's it's a nice little, I think, like, sound design Easter egg, is that line's in the script, to sort of nod to the fact that it is like a taxi clicking, but it also has some like T-Rex like guttural groans.
Yeah.
And,
nice whirring sound.
Yeah.
It's
both biological and mechanical at the same time.
Yeah. And it's very Jurassic Parky, right? Like, it's very like the honking, horny, you know, whatever sound of honking, horny. I don't know why I said that. You know, like the horn-ish honk of.
Everybody knows the T-Rex is the honking horniest of all the dinosaurs.
You know, and the trees moving. Like, we know that's Jurassic Park language, cinematic Jurassic Park language. But yeah, that's, I think I wrote down the time. Isn't it like 20 minutes into the first episode that the, like, I.
Oh, yeah, that's when we hear the first.
Yeah, the first sound. And so I was like, imagine being a viewer watching this ABC pilot that you've seen advertised. And I don't remember how they advertised it. Did they advertise it as like a mystery box show, or they were just like, you know,
Gilligan's
Island? But
what was it they called it when they advertised it?
Wasn't it like Survivor, but real?
No, it was like Castaway the Series.
Yeah.
No, like, that was where the idea started. So they advertised it as like a plane crash lost on an island, and
so you're
the whole
it.
Like
yeah.
What's going on in the jungle thing came out of nowhere.
Yeah, so imagine you're at home in 2004 or whatever, sitting down and watch ABC, and then this like crazy shit starts happening, and then like all the people on the beach's faces reflect your faces as you're just like, oh, what? Anyway, yeah, so that all happens, and like, you know, the thing that Lost also gets a bad rap for is that the mysteries weren't like satisfyingly explained or whatever it is. And we can litigate that many years from now when we finish watching this show. But like, I think for me, it doesn't matter because the character stuff's so good. And so I think it's just fun. Like, just maybe, I mean, it's fun to theorize and it's fun to get like all tied up about theories and stuff like that, but also just enjoy the like, what the fuckery of, you know, this added element of danger to this plane crash story.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, because I joined it so late, by the time I watched it for the pilot for the first time, I'm like, now that's the series that I signed up for. See, that's my,
you receive not a good impression.
Yeah, it's not a good impression. I need a lot of saliva and clicking for it. It's just not my best sounds. Neil.
Mm-hmm.
What size is this monster that it could yank something upwards from a fuselage and then knock it down?
I mean, it's pretty fucking big, Dave.
Yeah.
We're going to need a bigger beach.
Is that a technical unit of measurement?
Well, I don't want to ruin it for people who are just watching it for the first time. I think what they establish really well by doing what Joanna very rightly described as sort of the Jurassic Park treatment, where you never see it, you never see the monster. Well, we haven't seen the monster yet, obviously, but you can see sort of the way it moves and the way it affects trees. And I remember thinking when I first watched this pilot and had no idea what it was, that like it was like a giant gorilla. Like I was like, is this a backdoor King Kong thing? Like I very vividly remember thinking that that was something that was possible. So yeah, so you kind of have to think like giant animal at this point.
Yeah, or something that's in the trees but also knocks over the trees.
Right. So yeah, so it, very big, very sort of ominous. But you know, I think especially as we get into part two, it's very interesting to me how quickly it escalates, like the weirdness of the island escalates. Like, so we very quickly get a polar bear and then we get the weird signal and it's like, oh shit, like this thing was super weird from the beginning. And I think that was probably one of the reasons why it took off, because shows in that time were not as invested in the mystery. They weren't, it's interesting how Lost sort of exists in this space where it was pre Twitter enough. Well, it's apparently a very bad take according to the dog.
Yeah. The dog's
it was like pre Twitter enough. These first couple seasons that, you could kind of get away with having mysteries, and then, you know, later on people were, you know, pulling it apart thread by thread. But in the very beginning, it was just sort of, like getting punched in the chest by the TV show. It was like, holy shit, I have no idea what this show is, but I am starting to become invested in these characters. You know, at the end of the first segment of the pilot where Charlie, what is the end with the line where he's just like fantastic
where
great?
Are we?
No. That's the end of the second part. But at the end of the first part, he has this little like pithy line when they hear the jungle rumbling. He's just like, yeah, fantastic or something like that. And I remember feeling exactly that way. Like, holy shit, this is just weird.
And I know, I know obviously we're going to get there, and I know that Neil's dog Nico is really excited for us to get there, but like another thing that happens like right after you first hear the sound in the jungle, right, is like, I guess when we come back from commercial break, and that's a fun thing about watching this show is you can tell where the commercial breaks are. When we come back from a commercial break, you've got a flashback to the plane and you've got Jack and Rose on the plane right before the crash talking, and that's the introduction. Once again, I don't know if this was like, you know, tipped when they premiered the season, but like that the flashback structure, and we get it again with Charlie and again with Kate in part two, is an integral part of this show, and the way in which the flashbacks will inform the present story you're telling is the Lost hook for me more than the mystery stuff is like. Like, how interesting to do not just like, okay, we're going to do Castaway, but the TV series. Okay, we're going to make this weird, like, monster shit, and it's going to be weird. Okay, and then we're going to introduce this flashback structure that's going to help us inform our characters and the story we're telling. Like, it's a what fascinating trio that we have here. It's really great.
And at first, the flashbacks don't, you know, I feel like we'll get into more of how the flashbacks become a thing of their own, but in these first episodes, it's not, I don't remember it being as jarring, because you know, what else are they going to do there other than like show us some of the crash? But I do remember sort of thinking like before these flashbacks, one of the other things that was in the commercials, the sort of money shot of this pilot was the shot of Kate on the plane where the back of the plane bursts open.
Mm.
So you knew some of that plane stuff was coming, but the extent of the flashbacks, I think really surprised me as season one sort of opened up, which obviously we'll get to.
Yeah. What I mentioned before, taking all the flashes out of the first season of Lost. And one of the things that I learned there is knowing the characters, having been the series before that, it is like surprisingly in the island performances because of the structure Joanna's talking about. Like, this is Lost. This is how we're going to inform our theme of the episode. The reason that I hooked so much into mythology, and I think that Neil was sort of like hinting at it before, is like up until like this show gets crazy and then we pick up the next episode and it's still getting crazier, and it's going to continue that momentum seemingly endlessly throughout its first season, where it used to be in television, if you wanted to have something like every single week depended on you having seen the previous weeks before, you could only do that occasionally, like your X-Files mythology episodes, or it'd be a really intense experience a la like 24 on Fox. There wasn't the idea that for seasons and seasons, we're going to assume we're bringing the audience along with us that has watched every episode of the show. Or if there had, it didn't capture as many people until Lost came along and was able to do like these mystery mythology things, which led to some advancements in, I think, serialized storytelling, but mostly just in like this idea that you could have this bait constantly in front of the viewer and then hide little things in the show, and because everybody was that with you, you didn't have to spend a whole bunch of time in the show going over previous flashbacks or explaining how long they've been on the island. All these things started to come up contextually.
Yeah,
but I wanted
really quickly, yeah, like streaming sort of helped, you know, like something I noticed, because I watched like the first few episodes of this first season before like doubling back and rewatching these first two to discuss with you guys, just to like reorient myself in the world of Lost. And like what I noticed, a fun thing that I noticed is like, you can't assume, if you're making television 2004, you can't assume that someone hopping on to season one or hopping on at any point has watched the previous episodes. And so there are little moments of recap baked into exposition baked into the episode, because, you know, it's not like, oh, I'll just binge all of Lost and then catch up. You know what I mean? Cause they were like reruns and TiVo, you know, it's like, it was just
like figure out when it was on, yeah, at 2 o'clock in the morning on ABC2 or whatever.
Yeah. It was just like complicated to try to, you know, like now people are like, oh, okay. I binged 3 seasons of Game of Thrones and I'm all ready for season 4. But like then, you know, you hear from your ex-boyfriend who's in grad school or whatever. He's like, hey, I'm 7 episodes into this thing. And you're like, okay, let me dive in and try to figure it out. So you see it even in this pilot, even though the pilot was aired together. And I believe the first hour was aired without commercials, but even at the beginning of episode 2, Charlie goes, hey, that airplane pilot that we just met said we were several miles off course, and so nobody knows where to find us. Like, he does a quick recap of what we learned in episode 1. And I just thought that's kind of fun to look out for.
Becomes sort of a fun, like, bridge between the way they used to make television stories and the way we're more familiar with now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it happens during the season, because there's no way by the time we get to like seasons 4 and 5, they're going to stop and be like, remember when the plane crashed?
Right. All right.
So yeah, we age out of it as a television series. All right. Yeah, we found the signals we talked about. We shot a polar bear. I'm going to throw to Joanna because we get the introduction of, Sawyer and Saeed, along with, flashbacks for Charlie and a little bit more of everybody else on the beach. But primarily Sawyer and Saeed are introduced, as you were saying, as possible leader characters, who have, you know, a conflict that is very based in 2004, it felt like watching it. It's understandable positions, but knowing what I know now about Middle Eastern people and Sawyer as a character, it kind of feels a little bit blunt because it's a pilot.
Yeah, I think I said in my notes some 9/11 bullshit, right? So, yeah, Sawyer accuses Saeed of like crashing the plane or whatever. They found these handcuffs. They think someone was a prisoner on the plane. This is a big fun. This is just so fun. There's so many fun mysteries. Like, what was Charlie doing in the bathroom? Oh, we find out quickly he was doing drugs. Like, who had the handcuffs? Okay, we find out quickly it was Kate. Like, some other mysteries will take longer to, we know why Jack has the alcohol bottle in his pocket. Like, we find out all this stuff in this flashback structure, but like, Sawyer accusing Saeed of crashing the plane. Is what, you know, and you're like, oh, that redneck racist and all that stuff like that. But you also have this other complimentary scene, and please, people should write in and let me know if this is like not well done, if Saeed is not well done on this show. I think there is some stuff that's problematic and we'll get to, but I think in many ways, Saeed is such an appealing character. And this was a good time to have an appealing Iraqi character like on screen, right? But, the scene he has with Hurley where he, you know, Hurley's like, just like, hey, we both got bullied by Sawyer. We're the same, you and I. And, you know, bonding over like, oh, I had a buddy in the Iraqi war. And then Saeed has that great, like, I was in the Republican Guard moment. I mean, which like, you know, given the accent that Naveen Andrews is doing here, like, you know, I would assume not American, but I don't know. I think it's a good moment. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think it's for the time it was a super subversive moment because you think like that was, we were like really in it in 2004 as a country. You know, that was in the heat of the Iraq War. And for them to, for Lost not only to introduce a character that was very specifically tied to that conflict, but then make that character someone you sort of very quickly become sympathetic to because he seems like a good guy. Also, I love the anchoring, and I'm glad we got to the heart and soul of this show, which is Jorge Garcia
as Hurley.
Hugo Hurley Reyes. he's such a, this is going to sound mean, but it's not. He's such a like pillow, like in the sense that every moment that he's on screen becomes delightful no matter what's happening. The scene that we see in the second part of the pilot where he's helping Jack with the surgery is a gruesome sequence that is hilariously delightful because Hurley's like, I don't know, man. I don't do good with blood. And, so to the point that we were making earlier, there's so much great character stuff and they had such a firm grasp, it seems, on who these characters were in that first sequence. Like, I love Kate, as we're seeing in her flashback, we see her put the mask on the marshal, even though they clearly don't like each other.
I wrote save the cat moment in my notes. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
So there's all these little moments.
This guy's being a dick to her, but she saves him anyway. And that's how you know, like, okay, even though Kate has the handcuffs on, we're still rooting for her because she is inherently, whatever her backstory is, she's inherently some kind of good person.
I mean, and with Hurley, you get that from the jump. I mean, I think one of my favorite scenes in the pilot is a very quiet moment where Jin is walking around trying to give people the food and he stops at Hurley and it's just the funniest language barrier scene I think I've seen on television where Hurley's just like, no way, man. No way.
And yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I'm glad the first one wasn't me.
Yeah. All right. the fact that you even have Sun and Jin, you know, characters speaking in Korean, like, and subtitled, or not, is, you know, like, in addition to Saeed and like all this sort of stuff, it's just like different for television, I think. And like to your earlier point about Saeed and like the time we were in right now, like this is the time when like 24 is a super popular show. This is just like, this is a,
everybody was hunting terrorists on television.
And it's like, let's have once again, we'll get to more of later sites, but like,
this well, that's the thing is like, we're going to get deeper into all of these folks in ways that may or may not be, problematic in their own hours.
Here's one thing I do love that they specifically did in the pilot around Sun and Jin, where every time we see Sun and Jin talking to each other, in Korean, it's subtitled, but every time we see them talking to a non-Korean speaker, it's not, to create this sense of confusion or sort of just create this, the more of a barrier between them. And it sort of brings the audience in on how sort of, they feel apart.
Yeah.
At first. That. Yeah. It's just so like, it's the, you know, JJ Abrams gets a little, we give JJ a lot of guff nowadays, but, he really, at that time, was very honed in on what he wanted from this very long list of characters that they're introducing in this 2-hour pilot.
Can we talk about, and I want to hear Dave's thoughts on this, because like, this is a funny thing as we discover the rhythm of this podcast. Dave knows the most, but he's our host. And so usually he like is used to throwing to us, but I want to hear Dave, what you think of this introduction of John Locke. Terry O'Quinn's character, who we get like some fun backgammon stuff and other things, but he's like, what do you think of the way he's introduced in this episode?
That was going to be my last thing I said before moving on to the storm. Guys, is there anything else we want to pick out of this calm section of the 2-part pilot? I have some calm Locke thoughts, and then that's going to transition with a fantastic sound into some storm thoughts.
I think Boone and Shannon. I'll give you one hardcore on-brand Joanna combo before we get to the storm.
This is the one. This is the one I was promised before the podcast.
Were you? When you said what you said about Shannon. No, I'm not going to talk about that. I will just say that Shannon is a character that I appreciate much more this time than I did the first time I watched it. And I think she has.
I think she has
a function that I didn't appreciate the first time I watched it.
I know she's inherently annoying here, but it really works. Like from an execution standpoint and from a writing standpoint, Shannon's very annoying in this episode. That's what I wanted to bring up.
But that's like her point. Like that's like I think it's.
I know. Yeah. Exactly.
Great. Okay.
I was very into the show, and that character is very annoying. Just you either speak French or you don't.
But she's like. But I like that she's like. Difficult. You like, we don't all deal with like traumatic experiences well. We can't all be Kate and like step up and be like whatever. And so this is the thing I like yammer on about when I talk about like you need to have all different types. The fact that you have a Kate type and you've got a Claire type and you've got a Shannon type and you've got a Rose type and you've got a Sutton type, like all of that makes this show work so well. You know what I mean? There are some types that don't work as well, and we can discuss those in the storm, but like, I was just gonna shout out 2004, ABC has, Shannon sunbathing in her bikini, which is less egregious than the long lingering shot on Kate in her underwear in the water. It is fine with me, and the show gets better, I will promise you, with giving us shirtless dudes to balance it out. I'm all about balance, right? But like, the Kate shot, I'm fine with, like, it's true that, like, if you're on a desert island, you'd probably, like, wash yourself in the water, maybe in your underwear if you decide to. It's just a slightly creepy lingering shot. And then we roll on with the rest of the episode. So, I love Kate. That shot is a little creepy. That's all.
I agree. I agree. 2004 me didn't agree. But 2004
me
was...
2004
me
did not agree.
It was definitely sort of a lesser form.
I was not looking for the same things
but
in television shows.
It is interesting that they juxtapose that the next character that she meets after that is Sun, who we've had this sort of opposite moment with. Where Jin is like, he's being very tough with her. He's telling, you know, to button up. She has that moment of defiance where she unbuttons her top button. And then she comes upon Kate, and Kate is sort of a totally different person in that way. I thought that part is interesting, but you're right. They linger on it. I mean.
Yeah, no, it's not that I have a problem with the premise of the shot and the exchange. It's just the way it's shot is just like a little creepy. But like.
I mean, the one of Maggie Grace in the bathing suit is also very lingery.
Yeah, it just is. So. You know. But we get that later with some of the guys. So, you know, fair, turnabout's fair play later on.
Your turn's coming, Josh Holloway.
All right. Locke is this very creepy bald gentleman who has a scar over his right eye and explains the game of backgammon to Walt, once again, very creepily. I mean, he helps Jack out with when Jack needs help getting somebody out from underneath the jet thing, and it seems to have found an orange somewhere and doesn't seem at all bothered, really, about being on this island, which reads as very creepy because there is a lot wrong with this island. I have more thoughts, but I think that's going to be it for the calm this week. Pilots part 1 and 2. That's it. We're on our way. First part down. Season 1, rest of season 1 to go. Thank you so much for joining us. Otherwise, we will see you in the storm. Storm time.
Ooh, let's talk about Locke.
Yeah, okay. So here's the thing that I learned about watching season 1 after season 6 had come out. Locke's always been the villain, and it's really clear. It's really clear, I think,
sort
from
of.
This pilot episode.
I still don't even think of him as the villain.
I don't think of him as the villain either.
Well, I mean, I think it villain would be... every direction that he pushes in seems like a good idea as the man of faith, but it's ultimately the man of faith part that is going to lead to what we find unsatisfying in Lost, or in the case of the final season, the actual antagonist. But in terms of how Locke's presented here in the opening episode, we don't know that the islands magically, you know, bestowed him with the power to walk, but every time
but
that
he does. And I think that's what makes him so weird in this first episode.
And when you rewatch it, you're just like, it's so fun to rewatch this. It's so fun to rewatch those opening shots where you see like Charlie looking woozy and you know why. And you see like blah, 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 and you know why. And you see Michael and the first thing he says is Walt and like all this stuff. Like it's so fun to rewatch. And Locke is the most fun to rewatch because his first episode is like 5 episodes in, isn't it? Like it's many episodes in before we.
I think it's
walkabout?
The one after next. Walkabout.
I think it's the fourth episode.
But that's just cool. I mean, like, it's so great that like he's playing this whole thing that we won't discover until several episodes from now. Like,
well,
he creeps out
next to episode 2 with like, "Or Adam and Eve," and he's like staring at 2 like dead bodies in a cave on a like weird island.
I think I'm softer on Locke than you are. That's
I think. Well, and I think they very intentionally wanted him like. What's unnerving about Locke is that he understands something that everyone else doesn't. Like, he understands something about the island that everyone else doesn't know yet. And he has, like it is such a profound thing that, like, it does not faze him that there's all this chaos around him because he's just gone through something that we have no idea. And it's just a massive thing. So I think just Joanna's right. Like when you go back and watch it and you know, it's like, holy shit. Like what a great performance from Terry O'Quinn.
And like the first is the, oh no, wait, no, that's, never mind. That's his episode.
So here are my notes about Locke for this.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the third person to hear the smoke monster sound, but then the second time the smoke monster comes during the rain, it is directly off a shot of Locke. Smiling at like the oncoming storm. So here's my question, knowing how the series ends. Jacob's drawing people to the island to test them or to find a replacement. He's been drawing the people to the island to test them forever. So things like Gary getting sucked into the engine because he wrote the Valenzetti equation book, is the island punishing people immediately through the plane crash? And everybody else, the idea is just try to survive. Everybody does, but then in order to, the weakest person that the man in black needs to target, he needs to have something vulnerable about them that allows him into the whole murder Jacob plot. So it's my feeling that it's Charlie doing drugs in the front part of the plane that actually draws the man in black there in the first place. He's looking for the weakest person of the new survivors to make his disciple. And it's because Lost hasn't, first of all, Lost is not weak. It's only about his faith and his, you know, search for answers, which he finds at the end of the first season, that I think really opens him up to being a tool of the others, to being a tool of Jacob, to being a tool of the Man in Black, or just to being a tool in general, starting to take things on faith.
Okay. Can we back tread for a second? Because like, even though I'm rewatching this, I'm like rewatching this having not watched it since it first aired. So
I was deeply unprepared for the storm.
I know. I've seen Dave's notes for this episode and I was already intimidated. So like Dave.
Sure, they were illegible. So that's why you're surprised.
But like, so your premise, like, let's just reestablish the premise of the whole show, which is that there are two forces on this island. There is an evil force that is the Man in Black / Smoke Monster. And then there is a force for good ?
I'll call it the Protector Force.
The Protector Force, who is Jacob, who is there on the island guarding the Smoke Monster to make sure it doesn't get off the island and turn the world evil. And
because of this debate they've had since they were children and they're bored, basically God beings, they draw people to the island to basically play with them.
So Jacob is looking for a successor who can take, you know, like sort of like the Grail Knight in The Last Crusade, looking for someone to like let him to, who can take over his role as protector of the island. So to test a sort of Job-like, let's test these people sort of thing. And the Smoke Monster is looking for a passenger to hijack to get off the island. Does that feel accurate?
So he not only needs a passenger to hijack, but Jacob needs to be dead and he can't kill him.
Right. Okay. So he needs someone to kill the Protector and he needs a way off the island. And so he's looking for vulnerable people and Jacob, the Protector Force, is looking for, people who are morally strong enough to take over for him.
He's sort of like a not caring God in the sense, as we especially see it in Abaterno when we see an earlier version of him bring Richard and the Black Sail to it. But like, he doesn't really care about these people. He's just like literally putting them through the ringer and trying to figure out. But in his speech, and he gives them all by the fire, in 6 before passing off the power to Jack, he's like, you are all incomplete. He doesn't take people out of their lives that are like doing well. You know, if you're happily married and have a whole bunch of kids and never leave your ranch in Australia, you're not going to be drawn to the island unless the island needs you. But all of them are broken enough that he wants to further test them to find the one that will. Yeah.
Follow up question. How are Rose and Bernard broken?
Yeah.
Maybe I just don't remember.
I don't think she has cancer, right? That goes away once they get on the island.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what she's
talking about. They don't want
to
leave.
Okay. All right. This is great. This is a great refresher and I really appreciate you slowing down to talk to me about this. So can I give you my unified thesis of Lost?
Sure.
Which dawned on me as I was watching, and then I want to hear Neil's unified thesis.
Is it an in-world thesis, or is it like Damon Lindelof got really tired?
No. Okay. I'm not here to trash the end of Lost. Watching this beginning, and especially like the first few episodes of the season, which we'll get to more, but like the fact that they chemistry tested Jack and Kate from the start, Evangeline Lilly and Matthew Fox, and then we basically I wasn't stoned. I just like thought this. The thing that connects The Leftovers, if you've seen it, and Lost is this idea that like connection is super important. Connecting to other people is super important. And we all have things that get in the way of that. And in Lost, this manifests as like, the ghosts of your past, your trauma from your past. And so like my unified thesis of Lost, despite the fact that they're not even my favorite characters, is that this is about two people, Jack and Kate, trying to find a way to connect with each other. And all through this, like, first season at least, it's like a near connection and then something about themselves and who they are pull them apart. And then at the very end of the series, like, if I think of the end of the series in the most positive way possible, it's about the two of them connecting, like, in the afterlife. She's so happy to see him. And they are finally freed from the things that, like, their own shit, basically, that kept them from each other. And that's, I mean, not to spoil The Leftovers, but that's a similar thesis of The Leftovers, honestly, is that it is ultimately a love story. And it's about, like, how hard it is to connect with people. Because I don't think that's frailties, you know?
I don't think that's invalid. I think that's the discovery that the two God figures couldn't count on. Like, they're out here being like, who's going to replace me? Who's going to be my guy to kill my brother? The surprise I think they both come to, maybe they should have already known it by the time Oceanic 815 crashed, because they have Russo, they have Desmond, they have Ben. But what I think they learn is that when they have a group of people that can operate together, like, from mutually love and respecting things, that though that bond is beyond even the magic that the island can work.
Oh, I like that. No, and I wasn't presenting my thesis as, like, contradictory to yours. I was just like, this is sort of what I got out of. I was like, oh, this is what I think the show is about. I mean, yours is lore based, mine is character based. Neil, hit me with your, do you have a unified thesis of loss?
I don't know if I have one yet. It's funny because I've rewatched Lost all the way through once since it originally aired. And I don't really remember much about that rewatch. So for me, this does feel like a lot of it is sort of going back through the memory and piecing things together. So I'm curious to see if my unified theory evolves through this rewatch. And, I think what's interesting is, especially as we watched the pilot this week, how much stuff had to be sort of engineered in real time. You know, like how much did they, what I've always wondered about Lost is how much did they really know when they started? And the answer, yeah, I think, is not very much. Like, they just
knew. I think you're very correct in that.
which I think is fine. You know what I mean?
Absolutely fine. And I think that they built out from J.J. Abrams' just sort of square, the edict that he had, where he's like, the island's weird. Like, there's weird shit going on the island. Let's start unraveling that mystery. And I think that it, you know, they really did a lot of character work in this first season that I think pays off really well as they sort of reverse engineer the lore later down the line. I do think I was surprised at some of the, I'm trying to remember what it was, but there were a few things that I was surprised at, like, how early we see that stuff. So one of my favorite ones, this comes from the behind the scenes, the French message that they're hearing at the end of this episode also has a reference. Shannon doesn't translate it, but it says, I'm going to the Black Rock, which is something that, like, how did they even know? Like, that's basically where the first season's going to end, or that's going to be super important in this pilot when they had not, it was not guaranteed that they were going to get picked up. You know, especially based on how expensive this was. So to me, that's sort of going to be the fun thing is pulling that apart. But no, I don't really have a unified theory quite yet. You both have very good theories. Mine will probably have something to do with Damon Lindelof getting tired by
which I also think is a valid theory, especially as we move onwards.
I think it's going to be a really interesting parallel, especially coming off of Game of Thrones, where it's like the first four seasons of this are like certified brilliant.
Oh yeah.
And then starts to get weird.
With like Lost and Breaking Bad, they have like, they're two shows that have like kick-ass first seasons. And then it makes the writers like really reach for a second season, and they both overreach to the point where like the promise of interconnectivity can no longer continue past those seasons. And I think both shows find a way to, you know, then become different shows. But yeah, these first two seasons of Lost are just like a ton of stuff like that. Like, I remember like wondering what books are on shelves later on, or like, did I miss something in luggage that was like strewn about? And the weird thing is you never knew if you did. until like the very end of the series, and
but
then you're like, oh.
But that's so fun, is like when people reading like Flann O'Brien or like other, you know, like, oh, this book was on Lost, so I should read it because then I'll understand Lost. And like, maybe it won't be helpful, but how fun, you read a Flann O'Brien book. Like, that's great. I mean, I don't see any harm. I guess I have no anger towards Lost. I know a lot of people do. And I think it's, I'm so glad we're doing this in these like final weeks of Game of Thrones, because it's like, it's going to be fun to reexamine whether or not an ending that isn't maybe the ending you wanted or isn't the ending, you know, you expected or whatever it is, does really like, invalidate a whole series, which is sort of the reputation that Lost got, the reputation that How I Met Your Mother got, like some of the things. It's like, oh, if you crash land at the end, the whole thing was a waste of time. And I really disagree with that generally, and I especially disagree with it with Lost. There's so much good stuff here. And we haven't even like met Desmond or, you know,
or Penny,
or Charles Widmore,
or Juliet,
or like, or Ben. Ben Linus. Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. Wait.
That's the funny thing about Lost, is how many characters it adds as it goes along. It's like, wait, this is about like 20 survivors.
Richard Alpert.
I mean, if you think about it though, all the main characters, essentially, we'll see this the pilot moment, like from their point of view at some point. Like, we're going to see Ben see it from the island. We're going to see the Tailies version of it. We're going to see Desmond cause it by not entering the code.
Nikki and Paolo, like it's, you know.
This becomes the day the pilot airs becomes like a date the series then locks into, which is always interesting because there's no way they plan that. Like, we're just going to write it, you know, to take place in September of 2004. And then 101 on island days later, it'll be, you know, 2007 for us. No. So yeah, I think Neil's eventual unified theory of here's when they got tired is just as worthy of being tracked.
Totally.
As, my storm theory and Joanna's theory, which I think is just going to be drawn out in the main podcast because it's a character show.
It's a character show.
It's about the character, stupid. That's all that was on the blackboard, right?
It's also a technically brilliant show.
It is.
Yes.
Wait, there's one other. Oh. Yeah, go ahead. I'll.
Well, one of my favorite details is in the pilot. Like, you know, there's just so many details that, like, whether intentionally or not, wind up being, like, so important later. I forgot to mention this in the comment. I should have, but it is very silly that Claire is the only Australian on this flight, or that survived the flight. Charlie Sharpie. Like, Charlie Sharpie is in the pilot. Like, that's cool, right?
Like, yeah, because he's writing on his fingers.
Yeah, he's writing on the tape on his fingers, and that's his Sharpie that he writes. I mean, presumably it's the same Sharpie. Maybe he finds another one. I mean, I'd be surprised if it stayed fresh that long. But yeah, Charlie Sharpie is there. Dave, can you tell us all the instances of the numbers in this first episode?
Nope, I can't tell you at this point. They didn't know the numbers were going to be a thing.
So they like
they
retconned like very.
They're like, what row was Jack in? Oh my God, that's a number.
That's awesome. I love it.
It's actually they mentioned this in the commentary track. The first time we hear any of the numbers are in the broadcast that they're seeing at the end.
The Russo's broadcast.
Nice.
The French broadcast.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So that's the first time we occur, and 23 is in there, 15 is in there. So that's the first time that the numbers really occur. And it does sound like they just sort of had no idea there.
Yeah, what numbers did we use? Okay, we'll just put these together and make them a code. Well, see, the numbers, which we don't have to get into now because we will get into it for the episode, the numbers in the storm, I would guess, are the coefficients of the Valenzetti equation that bring the Dharma initiative there in the first place. So there's a mathematical equation that actually predicts when Jack's going to save the world. And
Faraday! Anyway. We have Faraday, is such a Dave character. I'm excited. I'm excited to watch Lost with you guys.
Yeah, good. We'll get to that in 2020.
Yeah.
Dan Faraday. all right, guys. I think that's going to be it for the.
Oh, ooh, can I say one more thing?
Oh, yes. Okay, go for it.
Okay, on the technical brilliance of this pilot, one of the most impressive things about it is that all of the plane stuff, all of the motion of the plane crash was done on a set that was not moving. Because, you know, like you would imagine they would shoot something like that now, is like put it up on a gimbal and you just rock the set back and forth. But all of that, the plane, the The actual set did not move. It was the actors moving, and it was the camera moving. It was also J.J. Abrams tapping the film canister on the camera to make it shake as they were filming. So zero of the plane crash, the plane is moving.
That's amazing.
It's insane.
There's another time in the pilot where they're running away from the cockpit because it's falling.
Oh, I posted a GIF of this.
The actors aren't moving. It's all done through camera motion.
They're running in place in front of a long lens.
they didn't have enough space to actually do the full run.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the plane stuff is incredible. The Steadicam operator on this, whose name it's Greg something, we'll get to him.
I will shout out a sneaky MVP of this episode, these episodes that we haven't talked about yet, which is Michael Giacchino, right?
Oh, Giacchino.
Oh, yeah.
Giacchino, if you watch some of the behind the scenes, which of course I did, looks so young. All of these people, like Giacchino is like...
Everyone looks like they did before they ran one of the most successful television shows.
I got to go watch Drew Goddard and Michael Giacchino score Bad Time at the El Royale. And they were reminiscing about working on Lost together. And I was, you know, they were talking about like how quickly they're having to turn over stuff for Bad Time at the El Royale. But like, but Giacchino was just laughing because they were both basically like, we were born in the crucible of TV. And when you're born in the crucible of TV, like movie making is luxurious by comparison. And I was like, well, you know, what was hard about TV? And Giacchino was like, oh, you know, I'd get like 20 script pages with like a day to write like music for them. It's fine. That's how Lost was. And I was like,
Other fun facts.
Boom.
Giacchino related fun fact is that they actually made instruments. They made some instruments that were used for the soundtrack from pieces of the plane.
Yeah.
So like there was like a string instrument they made from part of the wing and they create some of those like really weird haunting, like sort of offbeat sounds that you hear every once in a while in the score, which is just like, this show is just insane. Like when you go back and look at it, it's like where they even started was just at such an advanced level of creating television that we probably take for granted now, but back then it was like absolutely nuts.
Nuts.
Yeah. One last thing about all of that. Do you know what the sound is? Cause I don't, when like the flashback sound, that's a very important sound of this TV show, right?
The plane engine flashbacks. Isn't it a plane engine?
Is it? Is that what it is?
Isn't it the poo sound? Like the.
It's like a sucking, no, the end, it's like the a end of the episode Lost. Sound. Do you know what I mean? When you're going into like a flashback, it's like.
Here's what I will promise you, Joanna Robinson. By the storm of next week's episode about Lost, I will know the answer to that question.
Oh, and or so, like a million people will have emailed us.
Oh,
spoilers@gmail.com if you know.
I thought you meant the sound at the end of when the logo comes. The pop sound.
No. I mean, like when you go into a flashback, and I wanted Dave to be like, "Oh, well, that's the sound of the chicken fryer turning on at J.J. Abrams' favorite restaurant."
Oh, I think it's the plane engine, but maybe I'm wrong.
That sounds
right. We'll check it out, and I will have true facts for you next week, guys. Until next Wednesday, we'll talk about the series finale of Game of Thrones. Where can people find more of your stuff online? Let's start with Miss Joanna Robinson.
Well, you can find me on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter @JoeWroteThis, or you can listen to me talk about other things on the Vanity Fair podcasts, Little Gold Men, and Still Watching.
And Neil Miller.
Get me over at filmschoolrejects.com. Get me on Twitter @Rejects, where I have a feeling I'll be making a lot of Lost GIFs. It's just going to be a thing. And don't forget to follow the show @StormOfSpoilers and email us, stormofspoilers@gmail.com. If you have Lost thoughts, here's the thing. When you email us, you can email us questions about any of season one's episodes right now. If you have them, just tell us what episode you're talking about, and we'll sort of sort them out as we go.
Perfect. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter @DA7E, on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, at Thrillist.com, and at Polygon.com. And we will see you next week on the beach.
Don't fall down on the beach.
Don't fall down on the beach.
Don't fall down on the beach.
Jack does a pretty good job of not falling down.